Christopher Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
You're a 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, Central Valley, and for people who prefer flour tortillas over corn tortillas for their tacos, it's okay. You can come out of the shadows now, even though it's a little odd. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN, Fresno.com. Your 2-hour morning tour begins right now, 3 minutes, 18 seconds past the hour of 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Beautiful morning here in the Central Valley. Didn't see any fog coming in. Very clear. Nice. The rain, at least for now, has stopped. I hope that your morning gets off to a great start whenever that happens to get going for you. Technical director of the program, producer. He's a hockey guy, Sharks fan, Giants fan. Russ, keeping us going in the right direction. On the program today, our usual encore, 7:35. This week, it'll be Tom Van Herren, ESPN college football and recruiting reporter. We talked a little bit earlier this week about the transfer portal, National Signing Day versus the early signing period, and just how relevant National Signing Day still is. It's still there. It's not going away, but it really doesn't have the same significance that it used to have just because of the 65-hour period. It's 3 days, but it really works out to 65 hours in the middle of December. 8:05, he's back. Producer of Big Ten This Morning, Tony Landry. We'll talk a little college basketball, maybe a couple of picks here and there, maybe one pick in particular, and bat around the NFL draft just a little bit, and also Nick Shager. Nick Shager, as always, 8:35. A couple of decent films to tell you about. We'll also talk about his beloved Boston Celtics. It's really hard to get around that. He may be a film critic for what he does on a daily basis. That's the day job, but he is a sports fan. I think he'd like to trade places with me anytime. I wouldn't want to trade places with him because I wouldn't know what the heck I was doing. I just go to movies and watch them, and either I like them or I don't. Big game tomorrow afternoon in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at that little building we call the Pit. And I've said it many times, if you've never been there, that should be, for a college basketball fan, it should be a bucket list. And especially for a Fresno State fan, it should be somewhere that you try to get to sometime. It's really a great place to watch a game. It is, as Julia Lopez said to us yesterday when she was in here, and she grew up in Albuquerque. She went to Colorado State, but she grew up in Albuquerque. And it's a place that you just can't hear yourself think. And there's usually 15 or 16,000 in there, but even when there's 7 or 8 or 9,000 in there, it's just deafening. It's a deafening place because the entire area, the entire seating area, and the court area, it's all below street level, so the noise has nowhere to go. This is a game I'm going to be going on ESPN New Mexico a little bit later this afternoon, the Jim Villanucci show. Good to be back. They had me on when the Lobos were here in town for the 82-70 Fresno State win. That was a game, if you remember, could have gone either way. It was a 12-point win. Fresno State could have won that game by 20, but New Mexico could have won that game by 20. Both teams didn't shoot too well that night. both teams had a bunch of open looks, especially New Mexico. Fresno State's defense that night wasn't great, but at the other end, Deshaun Taylor in particular, they just couldn't stop his penetrations of the hole. Same with Braxton Huggins. So it'll be interesting to see how this game plays out tomorrow. Fresno State lost at New Mexico last year, you'll recall, and it was a game that was significant because I'm just trying to remember back. It was a game that they pretty much expected to win, but it was the last regular season game. It was overtime. They lost 95-86, and that changed the seeding in the Mountain West tournament. And I forget who Fresno State would have played or who they would have played, but it turned out they ended up playing San Diego State. And San Diego State was a team that Fresno State beat here at Save Mart Center and beat down in San Diego. But, you know, you get into that whole deal. I don't know why it's a little odd, but it is. You try to beat a team a third time, and so many times that third time is nearly impossible to win that third one. And sure enough, they got into the tournament, and they lost by 12. And it was a game that San Diego State kind of controlled. And all of that was predicated on that Saturday afternoon. It was actually evening in the pit when the game went to overtime. It was a game that Fresno State really could have. I'm not going to say should have. I don't like to say should have, but it was a game that Fresno State could have won in regulation. And it just didn't work out that way. And if you remember, if you watched, if you listened, you just got the feeling when it got to overtime that it gave New Mexico some new life, and that was all she wrote, and that was pretty much the end of the season. Because going in, I wasn't confident when they had to go up against San Diego State, even though they had won the first couple of games, and it was not a great way to end the year. The Fresno State lost three of their last four games, losing their last regular season home game to Wyoming. You'll recall that was a bad loss, 78-68. But this team has avoided that kind of stuff this year. This team, 18-6 right now, 9-3, tied for second in the Mountain West. And this weekend, interesting slate of games this weekend. Utah State, as I said, they're tied with Fresno State. Utah State is in Colorado Springs to take on Air Force. That's always a battle. Air Force is always a battle, even if they have a team that's it's average at best. And Air Force's team is. They're 10-14. They're 5-7 in the conference. They've been competitive in a number of games this year. But when you go out to the altitude, it can be a little bit of a hassle. But Utah State plays at altitude as well. And you look at the standings, and there can definitely be some significant movement in terms of if UNLV loses, if Boise State happens to beat San Diego State, if a couple of things happen, that'll all but ensure that Fresno State stays up in those top five seeding positions, so that they do miss that Wednesday night game. I think they will miss that, but it's going to be a good game Saturday in the pit. And as I said, I'll be going on at 4:05 with our good friends down at ESPN Albuquerque, the Jim Villanucci show. Always fun to have a chance to do that. At the end of the program yesterday. In one more thing, the very end of the program, I rushed through something that I wanted to just follow up with quickly here, just because it was a story that we had Josh Bean on from the Alabama Media Group, a story that made national news. I mean, national news to the level of getting the folks at ESPN, Jay Billis and Dick Vitale and any number of others talking about, and that is the Maury Davenport story, young lady who is... a terrific basketball player, and she's signed with Rutgers, but the family accepted a payment from USA Basketball. It's a standard stipend payment for when you play under 18 and what have you, U.S. under 18, which the U.S. won the gold medal on, but the money that they received, Tara Davenport, the mother, they didn't realize that it exceeded the 250 amateurism rule, because they said that they didn't know of that. Once they found out about that, it was several months later, they sent the money back. But she, Maury Davenport, this wonderful player, great student, just a all-around great kid in the community, role model for young kids, not the kind of young lady, young person, period, who you want as a role model for younger kids in high school and middle school and so on, she got suspended for the whole year. Well, the family sought a basically an injunction, a restraining order, that even though you don't think of restraining orders in that way, that's what it was, to allow her to play. She did come back to play, and she has been playing. Well, Alabama, the Alabama High School Athletic Association has not let this sit. And there was a hearing that had been scheduled for February 1st, and that was ostensibly going to be the day a couple of weeks ago that either the same judge that granted the injunction, granted the restraining order, the judge was going to decide either that, you know, the restraining order will be in place, she will be allowed to continue playing, or they're going to side with the Alabama High School Athletic Association. Well, what happened was the Davenport family, they amended their original lawsuit, and it was a smart move. Whether they needed to or not, it was a smart move going to the judge and saying, we'd like to postpone this hearing. Now, the judge certainly could have said no. You know, the judge could have said, no, we're not going to postpone the hearing. You've had plenty of time to get ready for this, and you're going to need to be in my courtroom right now. It was Pike County courtroom, Judge Reagan. But Judge Reagan did in fact postpone it. And so the hearing was scheduled for the original hearing was scheduled for January 22nd. It got postponed to February 1st, and then they came again. The family came again and said they wanted to try to get a postponement again, and the judge again postponed the hearing, this time to next week, a week from today, February 22nd. And all of the preliminary rounds of the Alabama State High School Tournament for boys and girls will have been completed by that point, and all that will be left will be the actual, you know, conclusion of the state tournament. And what's notable here is that if they don't leave everything the way it is and they decide to go forward, if they decide to go forward and you know, hear arguments on this, then that would start on that Monday, February 25th. But while those arguments would be going on, Maury Davenport would continue to be allowed to play. So it does make you think, and I talked to Josh through email, from the Alabama Media League, and I asked him, is there something in play here that you are able to ascertain? Have you been able to connect some dots, talk to anybody inside the legal system to have an idea of what's happening? Is the judge, in effect, going de facto in Maury Davenport's favor and saying, we're going to hear arguments, but I'm going to grant these extensions for the family, thereby allowing Maury Davenport to continue playing? Because it sure seems that way. Josh wasn't prepared to commit one way or the other on that, which I understand, and it would be pure speculation on his part, but that's what I was looking for. And it makes you wonder what in the world, you know, the adults in the room, we like to talk about that sometimes, or at least I do, and use that phrase, what are the adults in the room thinking here? What are they thinking here? What is the goal? What is the end game for them? Because even if, I mean, is it that important to them? The fact that everyone involved here, except for them, including the Senate pro tem from the Alabama legislature and other members, prominent members of Alabama's state government, have come, and forget about which side of the aisle they're on, Republicans, Democrats, doesn't matter. They've come out in favor of her, saying, isn't this enough? She missed a month and a half of her season. She got penalized for something that she had no part in. And once the mom understood everything that was in play, made full restitution of the $857.20, sent it right back to USA Basketball. USA Basketball flew down to Birmingham to speak on Maury Davenport and the Davenport family's behalf. And you have to ask yourself at this point, what is the end game of the Alabama High School Athletic Association. Is it nothing more than just they want to win, and they want to win so badly that they want to at least keep her out of a couple of postseason games? Because conceivably here, she could end up playing for as long as her Birmingham High School team plays. Maybe they get eliminated. They're not the best team in the state. They're one of the better ones. But maybe they get eliminated, and this case will still be going on, and you have to ask yourself, for what? For what reason would they continue to do this? And from a distance and from as much work as we've done trying to uncover kind of what's going on and talking to Josh. Josh came on the program for about 20 minutes a few weeks ago. The best that we can ascertain is that they want to get a win that badly. They want a win that badly, and they don't care that it is potentially at the expense of a young lady simply trying to finish out her high school career, someone who has been a great role model, a tremendous student in the classroom. She got into Rutgers. If you know anything about Rutgers, you understand that they could very easily be an Ivy League school, and they don't slide student-athletes in. They don't relax their entrance requirements because someone's a good basketball player. Boys or young men, young women, or whether it's lacrosse, football, doesn't matter. That's not how they play the game in Piscataway, New Jersey. They just don't do it. So you just have to wonder, do they have the best interests involved for not only her, her family, but the state high school athletic system going forward? My answer to that is no. You penalized her for a month and a half. Even if you want to err on the side of they knew that the money exceeded the $250 amateurism rule, even if you want to go that route, they paid it back. Maury paid the price of missing 6 weeks of practice and games. She's back. The money is back. Everything is good. What are you trying to do to her and her family? What are you trying to do to her? Is the win that important? Give it up, fellas. Come on. And we'll stay on top of this because I've been in touch with Josh, and I want to see exactly where this goes. Glad you're hanging out with us. It's the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel program right now on 940 ESPN.
We talk about different things with sports. We talk about the adults in the room, phrase I used a little bit earlier, phrase I use a lot. And really what it boils down to is whose best interests are being put at the top of the food chain here? Whose best interests are trying to be served here? I understand that the Alabama High School Athletic Association has their rules. Every state has their rules, their amateurism rules. I get that. But there comes a time, no matter what we're talking about, and really, it doesn't have to just be sports. It can be anything. It can be where you work. It can be something in the classroom. It can be something involved in your neighborhood, in your church, in your synagogue, wherever it happens to be, where you have some rules. You have a set of rules set up. And there are rules that are written rules, and there are rules that are unwritten. We all understand that. And what we also understand is that unless we're talking about laws where it's, you know, you can't break a window, break a door, and burst into a bank, a store, and just take, you know, you can't, there's laws that there's no gray area. But there are a lot of rules that go on that surround us in life, in our work, in school, in social activities, and so on, that there is a gray area. That there is a gray area. And in this case, there are rules set up in the state of Alabama, as there are in all other 49 states in terms of amateurism. And when you have a group of people, you would like to think, at the risk of repeating myself, but I think it bears repeating, you would like to think that a group of individuals who are smart and who have risen up the ranks in their profession, that they can look at a situation, that they can look at a young lady or a young man, they can see what happened, and they can see that it maybe this particular situation goes beyond sitting back and saying, well, unfortunately, that's the rule, and as they stated, it mandates a one-year suspension. And you think about the issues that would, reasonably speaking, mandate a suspension because somebody does something and does something in a way that they are completely 100% mindful of breaking a rule, that the intent to break a rule to benefit themselves, that the intent was there, and that whatever the rule was, whatever the situation was, you can say that 1 year mandated suspension is completely warranted because you're the adult in the room. You have risen to that position. You understand how to read the rule, read the offense, and read the room, read the environment surrounding all of that. Conversely, or maybe I should say similarly, you also have the ability to read the rule, read the offense, and read the room from the perspective of there was not malicious intent here. There wasn't intent here to gain something and play dumb intentionally. You know, they tried to say, the talking point here was that Maury Davenport's mother, Tara, is a middle school teacher and coach, so she should know the AHSAA rules. She said, we're middle school. We don't have any issues of amateurism going on because we don't have any 12 and 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, just turning 14, going and playing in any kind of competitions that are going to be involved where there's going to be money in play. And just the fact that you would think that the people involved here would say, you know what, even if they wanted to say, well, Ms. Davenport, talking to the mother, we're still inclined to believe that you understood on some level that you should have made someone aware of the $8.57 and 20 cents check. You should have made someone aware. We still have issues with that. You can still go to that point and say, I can even see them saying that. I can side with the Alabama High School Athletic Association on that point. If, and this is the big if they then followed up by saying, however, you made restitution here. You sent the check back. You did that, and we're good. We're gonna call it good here and let Maury Davenport finish out her year playing with her team and having a last go-round as a senior. Great student, great player. We're going to send her off to Rutgers the right way. Far too often, the adults in the room with young athletes get in the way and make a decision that is wrong for everybody. Now, having said that, it reminds me of some of the shows that we have on this station in terms of dealing with high school sports and high school athletes and a variety of different things. One of those shows is on Fridays. It is The Zone. the hosts of The Zone for a long time. They were gone for a while. I don't know if they were on an island somewhere. Maybe they were off gathering pineapples and working up content for the next year. But it's Nick Papagni, the Pagmeter, and the gentleman who's going to join me right now, Nick Anderson. Mr. Anderson, good morning to you.
CG, how are we doing this morning?
We're doing great. We're talking about adults doing the wrong things out in Alabama, but adults doing the right things. You and Pagmeter are going back. You start at 3:30 today, do you not?
We do. We're going to be a special time. We're going to kind of bounce around, I think, for the next few weeks just because of scheduling. But normally it'll be on at 4 p.m., 4 to 6, CG, over at the Fieldhouse live.
Fieldhouse is great. I've done my show there, and I've done Game Day Live there a couple of times. And, folks, if you haven't been out there, a good thing for you to do would be to find a way to check these guys out. On you can do a couple of things at once. You can go check Nick and Pagmeter out at, you know, between 4 and 6 or 3:30 and 6, and also eat some of their great food. I don't know if you've had – I'm not a tater tots guy, Nick, but they have the greatest tater tots, I think, perhaps in Western civilization.
You're talking right up my alley right now. So you're referring to the loaded tater tots.
Yes.
Yes. And I'm all about the loaded tater tots. My wife and I go up there and just order the loaded tater tots and nothing. Well, maybe a couple of adult beverages to go along with that, CG, but the tater tots are definitely an item of interest up there.
We should also point out the adult beverages up there include a drink that they have made special for 940 ESPN. It's called the 940. It's a strawberry whiskey sour, the strawberry being, of course, trying to represent the red and the red and black color scheme here. So we've got about a minute here. Tell folks who haven't listened to the program what you and Pagmeter are going to be generally talking about week to week.
We're going to bounce around a little bit. We're going to grab on some hot topics. We'll talk high school sports like we have in the past. And you know as well as I do, Pagmeter is probably as good as anyone with local high school sports. And he seems to have some good contacts out there. So we'll primarily be talking about that. Today's show, we're probably going to focus on the seedings, the playoffs, some of the games last night on the girls' side of high school sports, and then the high school basketball, along with the basketball games this evening, which will have some good matchups, I believe. Well, I don't want to give everything away, but you got to tune in to get some of that information. And, of course, we'll definitely focus on some local colleges and talk a little bit about some of the players and just focus overall on what we're doing here in Fresno and in the Central Valley, of course, and trying to get over towards the coast as well, since the coast is kind of what we would refer to as local now, since they are part of the central section. So definitely want to include them. And as you well know, we got a 50,000 watt blowtorch, so we do reach over there. So we want to try to encourage more listeners on the Central Coast.
There's no question, folks. So the 50,000 watt blowtorch goes up to Sacramento, to the East Bay, Monterey, and then to the north end of the Grapevine. He is Nick Anderson. He's part of The Zone, Fridays 4 to 6. Today is going to be 3:30 out at the Fieldhouse. You can find Nick on Twitter at the letter N, the number 2, AAA Sports, N2AAA Sports. Pagmeter is at Pagmeter. Nick, a pleasure. I'll stop out there sometime, say hi to you guys, because it's not too far from where I live. Welcome back. Good luck in the first show today. Don't eat too many loaded tater tots.
We'll keep it down. Appreciate you, CG. Have a good rest of your show.
All right. Thanks, my man. There you go. The Zone on Fridays. They are back. It's Nick and Nick. It's Pagmeter and Nick. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
You always hear me whining about weather here because I'm a Midwesterner, so I like snow. I don't like 25 below, but pulled in here into our building the other day, and one of the cars in the parking lot had probably 2 or 3 inches of snow on top because he came from Coors Gold, which, as all of you know, is not far from the south gate of Yosemite, and he had told us that he got 10 inches of snow the night before. I just one night in Fresno, can we get a little snow? Can we just anything? I'd be okay with that. I won't be able to sell that to friends back in the Midwest or to friends back in the Northeast who have had quite enough of winter. There's no doubt about that. One of those friends is Tom Van Haren, and we love having Tom on the program. It's been too long since we've had Tom on the program, but Tom works for ESPN, and he is all over college football and recruiting and cake, and we bring Tom Van Haren on right now. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing well. I was going to throw this out there. If you want to switch with me, I'll happily move out to Fresno, and you can come to cold, blizzardy Michigan if you want. just if you want.
Oh, is it, now you're in Michigan. I didn't know you were in Michigan. I have some friends in Detroit and in Chelsea, actually, and yes, they share your view that they don't want to hear me talking about weather when they look and they see it's 57 here, and then I complain, Tom, that there's a chill in the air, and then the phone gets disconnected, and that's that.
Yeah, this is about the time in Michigan where everybody gets to an anger level because we haven't been outside for about 4 months. So we're all, if you come to Michigan, if you're visiting here and everybody's a little bit feisty, that's cut them some slack. We've been inside for 4 months.
Listen, I can relate so well, Tom, as I've mentioned to you before. I spent 6 years in Fargo. And, yeah, it's just, you know, the underground tunnel is getting an idea there. The people want to start building those. So, Tom and Adam Rittenberg, another friend of ours who comes on the program a lot, Tom and Adam wrote a great piece together called Portals, Waivers, and the Future of College Football Free Agency. Interesting term to juxtapose with college football. We'll get to that in a moment. This is a subject, Tom, that we talk about on this program a lot. We're the flagship for Fresno State, so this is right in our wheelhouse. I'll get right to this part of it. I've just never believed that broadening the ability for players to transfer, relaxing the rules, giving them a little bit more latitude and freedom would result in what many are calling free agency. Because you and I both know with transferring, you're learning a new system, you're getting acclimated to new surroundings, you're making new friends, that there's a new social climate. It's not as easy as an adjustment as many want to believe. That said, so is what you're hearing a major concern from coaches, that there's going to be just this huge upheaval of players wanting to go all over the country to different programs?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of the coaches that Adam and I talked to for this article are concerned with the way that everything is starting to go, because these rules are new. And so everybody's kind of feeling everything out, where this transfer portal is new. There's the red shirt rule that we saw Kelly Bryant use to his advantage and take advantage of the 4-game rule with redshirting and then transferring. And I think coaches, now that the season is over with, they're really seeing what the effects are of the transfer portal, where we talked to one coach and we talked to the NCAA who said there's over 1,000 kids in the transfer portal. Now, that's over quite a few different divisions, but there's a lot of kids in that portal. And I think the concern for on the coach's end is that if the NCAA allows these players just to enter the portal and then they're given a waiver to be eligible immediately the next season, there are no repercussions for the players to transfer, and they'll be able to just move from school to school as they please. And ultimately it's going to affect how they manage their roster and how they build their teams. And I think a big part of that nobody's really discussing right now is, and I'm going to try to make this real simple because a lot of this can get really complicated.
Sure.
But essentially in recruiting, coaches have are able to sign 25 initial counters, which are scholarship athletes. Now, that's not just high school football players. That's junior college players, and transfers are included in that as well. So the thought from the coaches is, with the early signing period added in now, if you lose 20 guys to graduation and then you lose 20 guys or 15 guys to transfer, that's 35 scholarships that you're losing, but you can only sign 25. So that's 10 scholarships that coaches would not be able to make up in that given year. And that's really a lot of where the concern comes from. We talked to the NCAA and a few other people about the waiver process and gaining eligibility immediately. And what we found from the NCAA was, since last year, 64 FBS players applied for immediate eligibility waivers and 51 received approvals. And I think that's a big concern as well for a lot of coaches, that 79% of players applying for waivers to be eligible immediately were granted. And I think their perception is that it should be the other way around.
So, and part of that is the phrase mitigating circumstances. And how does the NCAA define that? Is it loosely defined? Is that something that coaches would like reeled in and narrowed a bit?
Yeah, that's a big part of the problem, I think, with this is there's no hard rule on what mitigating circumstances are or what qualifies to get you approved for a waiver, what the criteria is or what the circumstance is. Nobody really knows what that definition is or how that's defined, and so you go into a situation, and I think Justin Fields is kind of sparking a lot of this conversation. Who the quarterback who transferred from Georgia to Ohio State, he was just granted his waiver to be eligible immediately next season, and of course Tate Martell, the quarterback who transferred from Ohio State to Miami, is waiting on his waiver request as well. But I think that's a big part of it for coaches, is that if they have a player who goes into the transfer portal or who even expresses interest in transferring, they really don't have a selling point for that player to say, hey, you know, you're going to have to go sit out a year. You're going to have to go learn a new system. You're going to have to be in a new environment. They don't really know if that's going to be the case. The player, judging by the factors and the numbers that we have, as I mentioned, 79% of players that are requesting a waiver are getting it. The player, I think now as we move forward in this, I think they're going into it thinking, I have a good shot at playing next year and playing right away, so why not test the waters and why not transfer? And I think that's a big concern for a lot of the coaches.
My guest is Tom Van Herren. He's with ESPN, of course, deals with a lot of college football recruiting. His work is great. You see him on television. You see his work on ESPN.com. I want to take that a step further because you entered into this great piece. You brought Travis Leach in. He's an attorney. Assisting that the waiver campaign with Tate Martell, and he insists that that if an athlete feels, and this is right from what you wrote, negatively affected by his original school, quote, this is coming from Travis Leach, it should really be the burden of someone else to disprove that. All right, that's one box. Another box that's in this is what Gary Patterson from TCU said, talking about players wanting to leave, going through the transfer portal, and he said it can't just be because you don't like somebody or somebody said something to you. We all have to live in a world that's like that. So I get what Coach Patterson is saying, Tom, that if your feelings are hurt or you don't like this or that, you just can't up and leave. But I think, isn't that trying to put too neat of a bow on it? Because a lot of times players do have, and it might not be health, it might not be a family member, but they do have legitimate reasons for wanting to depart a school, whether it's the social climate, whether the environment of the program itself, whatever the case may be, was something that just didn't mesh with what he thought it was going to be, and he wants to leave. Shouldn't there be that avenue to do so? And the player should have as much latitude, or at least close to as much, as a coach has.
Yeah, I think so. And my belief is that the player should be allowed to move around, and if they're unhappy, and if it's not the right situation for them, I think they should. There should be guidelines, but I do think they should be able to do that. And it was interesting for me because we spoke to some of the players who are going through the transfer process right now or who have transferred. Juwan Johnson from Penn State, Cameron Rising, a quarterback from Texas, and Asa Martin, a running back who's transferring from Auburn. And Asa Martin and Juwan Johnson, that was really the main sentiment from them was, you know, they both said, my dream is to make it to the NFL, and I've only got 3, 4, or 5 years to prove that I can do it or show what I can do. If I'm not in a situation that I feel comfortable in, if I'm not in a situation that I think I can achieve my dream and my goal, then why should I not be able to go somewhere where I think I can achieve that? And that was the main message, I think, from a lot of players, and that really – that was the voice that we haven't heard in a lot of these stories, was from the players themselves that are going through it. And I found it pretty interesting, their perspective. Cameron Rising was actually pretty honest and forthright about the waiver process, that he said he thinks that players should be able to transfer. He said the transfer portal was outstanding. It was so easy to use. It made his process really, really easy. But he said that he does side with coaches in terms of if you do transfer, you should have a legitimate reason to play right away the next season. That if you don't have a legitimate reason, then you should have to sit out a year. So you know, there's this back and forth with all this stuff. The players think they should be eligible. Some don't think they should be eligible right away. The coaches think that there should be some penalty. And I think the main factor that I took away from this, or the main message that I took away from this from both sides, was no matter the solution that you come up with, you're never going to have both sides.
Yeah.
Both sides come together and say, we're happy. This is good. With this situation, you're never going to make both sides happy. And I think that's what we have to look at with this, is what does the most good for the NCAA, for the student athlete, and for the coaches, because there is no one solution that's going to make everybody happy and everybody say, okay, this is great for everybody.
That's very well said. And one more thought about this before we talk about early signing day, early signing period, and versus the national signing day. Listen, as somebody who went through recruiting, but for basketball, there was, going back to when I played, there's always been, and you know this, Tom, the NCAA is always counseling, and it's written up on websites and what have you, that you're signing, you're committing to a school. You're not committing to a coach. But the issue that I have with that, maybe issue is too strong of a word, is that college, unlike professional in any sport, college is driven by coaches. And to suggest that a player, a five-star, a four-star, any star, is committing to Alabama because they're interested in the business school at Alabama versus playing for Nick Saban is ridiculous. And I it's commendable that the NCAA impresses that upon players, but I feel like that's a little bit swimming upstream to try to get players to understand that. Would you agree?
Oh, 100%. And I think, you know, the NCAA has worked more on the side of the student athlete in this case. I think with the in terms of the waivers, because like I mentioned, they've granted almost 80% of the waivers. So I think that their understanding of that, and when it comes to even creating this transfer portal, the idea was that, you know, a coach can't block a player from going to school X anymore, that the player just needs to notify the compliance department, put his name in the portal, and then he can get in there. So I think this is more NCAA student athlete friendly than anything. But what I would say to that, to your point, is I'm surprised that the coaches aren't more thoughtful of that. That you know, they move around a lot, and the coaching carousel happens, and they know as well as anybody that when in the recruiting process, that sure, the school and the academics can be a factor, and you know, the environment, the campus, and whatever. But I would say 99% of the recruits that I talk to, when I ask them why did you choose this school, or what sold you on this school, 99% of the time they say it's a level of comfort, and it's the relationships that I built, whether it's with the coaching staff or the players or whatever. And really, you know, this is sales. Before I did this in another life, I was in sales. And sales is about relationship building. And it's about getting someone to trust you and making them feel comfortable to make a decision. And these are grown men, adults, trying to sell recruits on their program and why they should come to that program. And so it's definitely about the coaches. And it's definitely about that relationship that you have and that comfort level. And you mentioned scheme, how they fit into that type of environment. Because if you commit to a coach, sign, get on campus, spend a year or two with that coach, build those relationships, and then he leaves and a new staff comes in, it could be a completely different environment, something that you didn't sign up for, that now you're not comfortable with. So, that whole charade of a kid should commit to a school, and even, you know, I hear from the fans all the time that this kid should be loyal to this school. It's like, I don't get that at all, because it's a kid trying to get to the NFL. It's a kid trying to accomplish his dreams. I don't know where the loyalty would come in when he's been there for a year or less in some cases, that he should be loyal to that program.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Tom Van Haren is my guest, ESPN college football and recruiting reporter, does a terrific job. Early signing period and national signing day. Where are we at with this? You know, it used to be national signing day. Boy, it was magical. We couldn't wait for that day to see who's going where. And now it's turned into a bit of a Broadway show. You know, whether it's national signing day or the early signing period with the hats and the magic tricks and the everything, but bands are getting signed up. But more importantly, does National Signing Day, Tom, does it still carry the same weight and significance because of that 65 to 72-hour period in mid-December?
No, I signing day in February has changed drastically from what it used to be, and it's crazy to think because this is just the second year of this early signing period, and I think last year in the 2018 recruiting class for that first initial early signing period in December, I think it was that one was just a feeling out process where for coaches and recruits and even us, we were, you know, as reporters trying to figure out what was going to happen. And I remember talking to a lot of coaches before that first early signing period. And I asked them, you know, do you guys have a plan? Do you know what's going to happen? Do you have a strategy? And a lot of them said the same thing. We've got a plan, but we don't know if it's going to work. And so I think that initial early signing period, everybody was feeling their way through. And then we got to this one this year. And it seemed that there was a better strategy, a more confident strategy from the coaching staffs. They knew what to expect, and they knew what they needed to do. And from talking to a lot of the coaches, the overall sentiment, the overall message was that most of the programs, most of the coaches were treating that December signing period as the only signing period. That if you're committed to our program and you don't sign in December, then we're probably going to view you as you're not committed, and we're going to go try to fill that spot with somebody else. Now, that's not everybody. Not everybody has that luxury of being able to do that. But the majority of coaches that I spoke with said that. And, you know, that was not just coach speak, because after that early signing period, we were only left with 41 ESPN 300 prospects who were unsigned, which was it was incredible. It was a rise up from – I believe from 2018 to 2019, we saw in 2018 it was 221 of the ESPN 300 prospects signed in December, and then in 2019 it was 260, I believe, somewhere around there. So it was an increase in the number of prospects that signed early. And the coaches, they said, we're going to treat this as the only signing period. And then in January, we're going to move on to the 2020 class. And that's really what we saw this year.
Last thing. Wow. Those are pretty telling numbers. Last thing for you. We've got about a minute here. Do you see a point where National Signing Day, because of what you just said and the trend over the last couple of years, could potentially get phased out?
I don't think it'll be phased out altogether, because you still have the top ranked guys, the elite level guys at certain positions, premium positions, who are going to want to wait and want to wait till February to make that decision. And you're also going to have prospects that are still leery of coaching changes and want to wait that out. So I think we're going to see an increase in the early signing period, but it will not phase out the February signing period either.
Well, listen, folks, doesn't get any better than this, having Tom Van Herren on, and I want to remind you his outstanding book, The Road to Ann Arbor, Incredible Twists and Improbable Turns Along the Michigan Recruiting Trail, written, of course, by Tom Van Herren. I strongly suggest you pick that up. It's great reading. Tom, it's been a while since we've had you on. It's always a great pleasure. I hope you come back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm happy to come back whenever.
Absolutely.
Talk to you soon.
Wonderful. Tom Van Herren in Detroit, Michigan. It's very cold there. It's very snowy there. This is the CGP. Coming up in hour number two, Tony Landry, producer of Big Ten This Morning. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
The studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP, Friday morning. Sun is out. Beautiful here in the Central Valley of California. I hope it is equally beautiful wherever it happens to be that you are listening to me right now. It is 3 minutes, 12 seconds past the hour of 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Yeah, it is gorgeous here, and it's that time of year out here where for a couple of months we get a lot of rain, a lot of fog. The temperatures range from 40s to 50s, and on a good day or a better day for winter here, if that's what you want to call it, it gets into the 60s, and then we turn the corner where suddenly it doesn't drop below 80 until, you know, I don't know, November. And usually it's more like 90 to 105. This is not the problem for friends in the Rockies, in the upper Midwest, and on the East Coast, and in particular Washington, D.C., although last couple of weeks, we talked to Tony Landry, producer of Big Ten This Morning for Sirius XM. It was actually warmer there than it was here. We welcome in our good friend, Mr. Tony Landry. How are you, Tony?
I'm doing well. Should we do the game? I'm currently sitting at 61 and sunny.
You are 61 and sunny. That is very impressive. Right now here in Fresno, it is sunny and 48.
Winner!
Wow!
Perfect.
Yeah, just.
I'm actually. This is the first time all year I'll say this sentence after my completion of the CGP. I'm going golfing today.
That's great. And have you found you are a big you are an avid golfer, and you in fact, when we were in the Midwest together, you played it smart. You never asked me to join you because you knew that would have just been foolish, and we would have been telling other people all day long, go ahead and play through.
Yeah, just go ahead, and you just go right around us. No big deal here.
Have you found some favorite golf courses out of the D.C. area?
They have a lovely municipal park set up here in D.C. where they have four or five that try to stay open as year-round as they can. Now, obviously, last week and earlier part of this week, we were dealing with what they call winter here, which is just 30s to 40s and rainy, which kind of sounds like you're kind of dealing with some of that similar
yep.
stuff in Fresno. But, you know, you can't, you know, we get the occasional snowfall and it closes things down. But it's been, I've got out a couple of times, and there's a few covered driving ranges near the house that I've gone to. So it's been good as I actually sit and watch the early round coverage of the Genesis Open on my TV before I go do this to motivate a little. It's different. I think a lot of your listeners over the years have heard me and you often speak of my heritage being from the Midwest. So the idea of golfing in February outside of, say, an Arizona or a Florida is still a very new concept to me.
Yeah, there's no question.
This is definitely different.
No question about it. You know, one course, well, there's a couple of them. I think there's three up at Pebble Beach. But if you ever get a chance to, you know, go with somebody to do a round at Pebble Beach, it really is spectacular. I've actually been a part of a group that was on a course there. I'm not going to say that I was golfing, but just to walk that course, you know, it's spectacular. I mean, the views are unlike anything anywhere in the world.
Yeah, it'll be the home of the 2019 U.S. Open this year as well. So you got the Pebble Beach AT&T Pro-Am last weekend there, and we're going to get U.S. Open coverage later this year. So it'll
yep.
be – it's one – you know, America has its courses that everybody knows you. Obviously, you have Augusta. You have some of the courses in Florida that make big news. But, you know, it's hard to put Pebble Beach – not in the top two, at the highest, the top three when it comes to American golf courses.
No, there's no doubt. There's absolutely no doubt. We're talking about Tony Landry. You know, there's some big college basketball games this weekend, and you and I talk a variety of different things. But the one game, and listeners here will be like, oh, CG's going to talk about Tennessee. But the fact is Tennessee is number one in the country. They're taking on number five Kentucky. And Kentucky lost in a very controversial ending earlier this week to LSU on a play that should be reviewable. I talked to a couple of different people about that this week. I know you know the play. You've seen it. It was offensive goaltending. There's no two ways about it. But they can only review the time. It's hard to imagine, Tony, that Kentucky at Rupp Arena could potentially lose two games in 1 week. I don't subscribe to the theory that because they essentially had a win taken away from them, that somehow that's going to motivate them more. If you can't get motivated to play, one, your arch rival, and two, your arch rival just happens to be sitting in the spot that you normally are in, then there's something wrong. This is going to be a great basketball game, but I am not prepared. When you look at these teams on paper, Tony, you see the way they match up in the front court and in the back court and the depth of Tennessee and the experience, or I should say the fact that Tennessee is an older team, which you don't see too often these days from teams that are in the top 8 or 10. I'm not prepared to just say Kentucky's going to win this game because they're playing in Lexington.
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting. We've had a couple of different guests on this week just to kind of talk outside the Big Ten when it comes to hoops, because right now in college basketball, the pressure building to March is getting more and more ramped up with every loss. I mean, you take a look at what happened to the Gophers with their big loss, and you have this just kind of this pressure that everybody kind of forgets until you get to mid-February. And this Kentucky team is interesting. C.L. Brown, the sports writer for The Athletic, was on with us, Myron Medcalf from ESPN. Mm-hmm. They both kind of echoed the same sentiment, saying, when was the last time you saw a Kentucky team that has almost kind of flown under the radar?
Yeah.
Like, they're not the Carl Anthony Towns-led 34-1 Kentucky teams that kind of barnstormed their way through college basketball, but they're also still a very highly ranked team that not a lot of people give, you know, the normal John Calipari Kentucky kind of ranking and mystique to. The problem with Kentucky right now is, you mentioned it, yeah, the ridiculous call that wasn't and that was with their last game. They're playing, hands down, maybe outside of Virginia, the best defensive team in basketball coming up this weekend. And this Tennessee team doesn't – I don't think they get the actual respect that they should be getting in college basketball right now, and that's ridiculous to say for where they're ranked. But I also think it's true. You don't see a team that's doing what they do, and on a national forefront, what is college basketball currently always talking about? Duke and Zion Williamson.
Yep.
They're entertaining. They're dunking. They're doing a lot of the things that you used to see in 80s college basketball when it was three guys dominating a court. Meanwhile, Tennessee is just this machine that just keeps churning out wins and grinding out against some of the best competition in basketball. And it's kind of interesting to see, and that's going to make this matchup this weekend really entertaining because, I mean, John Calipari is not the kind of guy that, you know, looks fondly on any kind of home loss during the season. Nevertheless, like you mentioned, what could be back-to-back losses as well.
Yeah, that's all very well said. And you know, it's interesting. We're talking with Tony Landry, producer of Big Ten this morning for SiriusXM. And the other night, Tennessee played South Carolina. And if you saw the score, if you saw the game, Tennessee won 85-73. Tennessee was a huge favorite. Coming into that game, South Carolina was 12-11. But the story of the game, and to show you how good this Tennessee team is, it was a 12-point win over a team that they're probably 25 points better than. South Carolina shot 61% from three. They made 14 threes, and they still lost by 12. And when you start looking at numbers like that, when you make 14 threes in a game, Tony, and shoot 61%, you're going to win most of those games. I don't care who you are. You're right about this Tennessee team. They're not getting a lot of respect, and they're fine with that, and so is Rick Barnes. The thing about the matchup Saturday night, tomorrow at Rupp, that I think is most intriguing, the most intriguing part of this matchup, is Tennessee's offense versus Kentucky's defense. Kentucky's defense, they have rounded the corner. They have done what John Calipari teams do. They have found their legs. Their talent is playing to the level to the skill level that they possess. Tennessee's offense, they are very much like Golden State. And follow me for a moment. It's not that they have shooters like Klay Thompson or Steph Curry, but they have this ability that they have shown all year en route to their 23-1 record, 19-game winning streak, and undefeated in the SEC so far. And that is that suddenly, you know, they're in a nip-and-tuck game, they're in a 1- or 2-point game, and 90 seconds later, they have a 15-18-point lead on you. With Grant Williams, who can score from anywhere on the court, Admiral Schofield, who could do the same thing, an unbelievable backcourt in Lamonte Turner and Jordan Bone. Jordan Bone is one of those guys that can accelerate with the ball and blow by every guy on the court, and he can jump out of the building. They can just humiliate you in a very short period of time. Where they get into trouble is when they start to have some mental errors. Sometimes Grant Williams can get into foul trouble. Sometimes their defense is not rotating the way it should, and a team that has a good backcourt that can penetrate draw in the defense and kick balls out to guys wide open on the wings, that's where Tennessee gets in trouble. Tony, as I look at the at these two teams, I think it's going to be one of these games. You look at the first 5 to 8 minutes, it's going to be nuts inside of Rupp. Can Tennessee weather that? I think they can. And I really believe the difference in this game may well be the fact that Tennessee is just so much more experienced. And at this time of year, that does play a lot into games at the highest level.
Oh, yeah, you have to absolutely look at the situation that they're going to get themselves in on Saturday. And I think you're right, that first 5 minutes is going to be interesting. I think it's going to be a situation where you're going to get one of two situations. You're going to get these guys that are going to try to feel themselves out, try to see how they want to kind of play the pace of the game. Or you're going to get one team that's going to decide, you know what, this is our game. This is nationally televised. Everyone's got eyes on us. We want to show what we are, who we are, and what we can do. And you might see a situation where Kentucky tries to come out and just empty both barrels early and tries to jump out to a 15 or 16 point lead and then use their defense, like you mentioned, to try to keep them kind of away from Tennessee, almost play a defensive style of game when you're up early, and then see if Tennessee can have one of those moments, like you said, where 15-1 run or a 18-0 run is something that Tennessee doesn't sleep now. So it's going to be one of those situations where I really think we're going to see a lot of entertainment. We're going to see a lot of just high movement kind of basketball. I think it's going to come down to like how the guards play against each other. These are guys that have the ability to score. But also the one thing about Tennessee basketball that's been kind of fantastic is when one of the names you mentioned isn't really in lockstep,
yep,
you get the situation where they start to really hand the ball off and really start to run an offense, which is kind of interesting because the most of the basketball that I watch in night in, night out is Big Ten basketball, which is first 1 to 51 wins. And I hope you're not ready to take a nap because there are a vast difference in the two teams that we're going to see on Saturday than, you know, your Ohio States or your Michigans, where I tell you what, you know, get your nachos during the first half because you're not going to miss much. So I'm interested to see like how these two teams decide they're going to take the, you know, pretty much things from the tip.
Yeah, I'm with you there. We're talking with Tony Landry, producer of Big Ten This Morning, Sirius XM, Channel 372. Tony does a great job. You look at one other aspect of this before we talk about a couple of other things. The last six games for Tennessee, margin of victory, 12, 12, 12, 17, 22, 17. The two games before that, at Vanderbilt, Tennessee wins in overtime, 88-83, and at home in Knoxville against Alabama, 71-68. The reason I mention those is because in the Vanderbilt game, Tennessee got off to a huge lead and then just let it all went away. They benefited from some calls in that game and ended up winning, you know, exerting their overall power and skill and put down Vanderbilt. Alabama, that game, Tennessee had a huge lead, and then Bama came out in the second half and just took it to them. Tennessee has not, those two games aside, has really not had any games like that all year, except for the other one, which is the one they lost in overtime to Kansas when they played in Brooklyn. If Kentucky's going to, it's almost hard to hear myself saying this, Tony, but if Kentucky's going to have a chance to win this game, they do need to get out and get a lead, because I think it for Tennessee, if they're a legitimate national championship contender, as many have said, if they are legitimately going to make a run at the Elite Eight or the Final Four, what I want to see is how they perform in a game where it is a close game or they're trailing most of the game, because that's not a situation they've really been in this year.
Yeah, no, you go back to that first game, kind of like you mentioned, getting blown out to start the season is something that team never really expected was going to happen to them. And I think it took some time for them to kind of, you know, that loss had to set in for Kentucky and had to go, okay, we're not just going to walk into the gym, add water to the punch, and then we're just on our way. We actually have to play as a team. And that's going to be something that, you know, if they fall in, you know, that middle eight of the first half where Tennessee goes on a run and starts to put things together and they push their lead to 11 or 12 points going into the half, and you have to come out knowing that not only do you have to play great basketball, you have to outscore your opponent by at least 11 or 12 in the second half. That's going to be something that's really going to contest the Kentucky Wildcats. And I don't know. I think you're right. I think it's something that until they actually have that situation put on them, they haven't really had to deal with that, and they don't really know what to do with that. So I think this has the makings to be a really good basketball game.
No doubt about it. One more segment with Tony Landry. We're going to talk about a couple of other teams up in the top eight, top ten. Get Tony's thoughts on whether he thinks they are contenders or pretenders. Glad you're hanging out with us. It's Friday. It's the Christopher Gabriel Program.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Glad you're hanging out with us Friday morning. Central Valley to D.C., points in between and points down the East Coast. You can always tweet me at CG Program, as Jason Spears just did. Enjoying listening in on some Tennessee Hoops talk from CG Program on my drive to Atlanta. Gotta love that. You know, we just got to love that, Tony. I mean, whether they're here in the Central Valley or in the Peach State, we've got them covered.
You know, Coca-Cola, Chick-fil-A, we do it all here. Atlanta, Fresno, D.C., why not?
Have you tried, by the way, have you ever tried the at Chick-fil-A, the grilled chicken nuggets? Those things are great.
Can I admit something that's probably going to, Jason is not going to enjoy?
You know what, I feel where this is going. Go ahead.
I've yet to actually enjoy Chick-fil-A.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. That just...
I know, and they're everywhere out here.
I'm sending you
I was at Union Station yesterday, and there was one there, and I still didn't make it there.
I'm sending you a picture of me in a hockey jersey. I'm just going to tell you.
I think I have about 9 copies of that. So.
By the way, have you got...
One day, I'm finally just going to make a mirage of you in hockey jerseys.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Jerry West thing on the NBA jerseys. Have you gotten through Once Upon a Time in America? Because that movie is longer than the Super Bowl preview.
The Super Bowl preview, the Indianapolis 500, my last root canal. And I think the tax auditing I'm probably going to end up going through are probably just shorter.
Yeah.
In that movie. I did finish it in, I think it took me 2 sittings at 3 hours and 49 minutes. And for a guy that loves mob movies, I'm not quite sure what was the point of that movie.
Yeah, it got a lot of billing. It's got its good moments. I've always felt, in fact, we have Nick Shager coming on in a couple of minutes from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire, with one of their lead critics. I've always wondered why they didn't, the producers of Once Upon a Time in America didn't consider, editing and maybe taking, say, an hour and 20 minutes out of that movie. And then I think you have a gold mine.
It really, I think I texted you this while I was watching it, and it was, I don't know who edited this movie, but either it was their first day or their last day editing film, because there were just... whole scenes of just like no audio and just people staring at each other. It was odd.
Well,
I mean, you'd think James Woods, Bobby De Niro, you know, the cast of thousands that are in it. It was not the best thing I watched 2 weeks ago.
Well,
can tell you that.
Well, let's just, the staring at each other, just bear in mind, you've not lived in New York City. That's just a normal night at dinner.
Just Tuesday.
Yeah, that's just, you know, you go out with some folks, especially when you're in Queens or Brooklyn, and there's a lot of that. There's a lot of quiet restaurants with people walking around, servers walking around, and just a lot of, you know, eyebrow raises and little gestures with hands, and not a lot of talking, Tony.
Well, you know, whatever gets the job done, and as long as that you're just staring and not, you know, throwing knives or anything in a New York restaurant, I think you'll be all right.
That's exactly right. I want to talk about Duke for a moment. Duke... remarkable comeback against Louisville the other night, and that was a reviewable call at the end of the game, where it was the Louisville defender was in that protected area under the basket. It was the right call, and they end up Duke ends up winning. But do we sometimes give in any year Duke more credit than they deserve just because of those 4 letters on their jerseys? Coach K, and we just assume they're great, even though there's been some years where they've clearly been down from where they normally are, and we would see that, the fact that they'd be out of the NCAA tournament by the end of the first weekend.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a comparable comp to maybe college football, but Duke kind of has this weird thing where they can float around anywhere from 10 to first in the country, and they out-coverage everybody because of Coach K and the current slate of future NBA All-Stars that they have. But the hard thing is they've never really done, you know, what USC or Texas football or, you know, some of those predominant huge names that we saw forever. You know, Penn State, obviously not, you know, sanction-based stuff. But
right.
They've kind of fallen off by the wayside a little bit. We've never really seen the Duke, you know, 30th ranked in the country and, you know, trying to fight for a three seed or a five seed. You know, there really hasn't been that. So you really have to give them credit for what they've been able to accomplish. But they are one of the more overhyped college programs, hands down, just because of who they are. But who they are has been built over, what, close to 40 years now?
Of yeah.
One guy. I mean, think about if you put together a who's who is Duke basketball. I mean, it would read like the, you know, the 50 greatest players of all time. But they do get the hype train for good and bad reasons. And this year especially, I mean, they have every reason to be as hyped as they are. They have every reason for people to be tuning in and watching Zion Williamson and Cam Reddish and all these guys that are going out and doing the things they're doing. But what happens if in the round of 32 they go out? What are we talking about then? It's no longer, you know, these kids that could dunk and shoot threes that are going to go to the pros right away. It's what in the world just happened with those guys? We've talked about them for 5 months now.
That's exactly right. And since you do, last thing for you, my friend, in our remaining minutes, since you do cover the Big Ten like nobody's business every day, Michigan, they go into Penn State, and this is the second time, maybe the second time in as many years, or at least the second time that they've had a really good team, a ranked team, go into Happy Valley against a not-so-good team and walk out of Bryce Williams. I think it's – I'm trying to remember the name of their arena there in State College. Nice place, but they walk out with a loss. How good is Michigan, and do you and the people you talk to believe that Michigan – can make a big-time run like they did last year?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. When we have people on from Michigan, they like to talk about Izzy Brazdeikis and everything that he does. And, you know, John Beilein is the greatest drop a play out of bounds, out of a timeout, halftime coach you'll ever hear of. And, I mean, a lot of that is true. When we get more of the national people on to talk about them, it's kind of interesting. They have an idea that this team really could be something special. They could make something kind of like their little brother up north in Michigan State, kind of go on one of those Izzo runs again where they just kind of barnstorm teams and win by six and the total score doesn't hit 160. But it's one of those things where it kind of depends on how they go offensively. Michigan right now is on a Virginia level of defense where they will just suffocate you from scoring. But it's not like they're turning around and scoring 95 on top of that. I mean, they're winning right. games in the 60s some nights, and that's it works in the Big Ten because that's how Big Ten basketball is played. If they somehow end up, you know, in the Sweet 16 finding themselves against Gonzaga, who is winning games by 30 right now, they're in a world of hurt. That is not their style of basketball. So it really comes down to matchups when you look at this Michigan team when they get into the tournament because they will – they'll win their first few round games, in my opinion, pretty easily just because they play better defense than most of the teams that they're going to see kind of in that 14 to, I don't know, 12, maybe 15 range, right. wherever they end up getting seated. But if they run into a team that shoots well and they have an off night defensively, they're in a world of hurt because they are not the Tennessee Volunteers like we talked about that all of a sudden can turn it on and be up by 12 in the bat of an eyelash. So it'll be interesting for John Beilein and Michigan. You know, we had Steve Johnson on today from Penn State, their men's basketball and football play-by-play guy. And it's, you know, they had their moment in the sun. They were standing on top of the scorer's table, singing to their fans and doing everything Penn State does. That's more to do with the fact that you just beat the 7th team in the country.
That's right.
And you're a terrible basketball team right now. More than anything else. I mean, it's an ugly loss, but you look at Ohio State lost to Illinois. I mean, you're seeing some really weird things in the Big Ten right now. One of the most common terms that we hear day in and day out on Big Ten this morning is the cannibalization of the Big Ten, where you're seeing guys that are 10-15. You know, Nebraska snaps a 7-game winning streak against hopefully tournament-bound Minnesota, and then Nebraska, you know, pulls that upset. So it's one of those things where you're going to see a lot of stuff down the stretch of the last 3 weeks of the Big Ten season of, you know, I wouldn't be surprised with this Illinois team that, you know, people are not paying any attention to for good reason if they didn't go on some kind of a run. And if they put up a good showing in the Big Ten tournament, you might see a real surprise, you know, bubble team sneak their way in there.
Well, that's all good stuff. And I before we depart here, I've got to update you on a couple of things based upon what's going on Twitter right now. Jason Spears weighs in again. I'm not sure you can have Tony Landry on again until he has the life-changing deliciousness that is a Chick-fil-A, period. That's been noted.
You know what, Jason? I am dating a girl from Georgia, so I'm going to blame it on her.
I didn't know you were dating anybody. We'll have to talk about that. And then I wrote back to him, and I just, you know, said Fresno State, we've got them covered, talking about basketball, SEC. And I threw in one of my favorite schools to talk about in Golden, Colorado, the Colorado School of Mines. And I will tell you this, and I'm being completely serious, anybody anywhere in the world that even mentions the word Mines or Colorado School of Mines, their social media department, they are all over it. They will, you better come with your A game if you're messing around with Colorado School of Mines. I made the comment that they're in there, and Mines Athletic, it's at Mines Athletics, wrote back, responded to the tweet saying, for example, we've won as many games in a row, 19, as Tennessee, just saying. I'm ready to buy a T-shirt, Tony.
A good social media person will take you a long ways. Case in point, Wendy's, the fast food chain. They are a great Twitter follow. I tell you what, if we were ever going to do a Big Ten This Morning CGP collaboration, I got to think somewhere around the midway point would be the Colorado School of Mines, wouldn't it?
There's no question. And by the way, just so you know, they just responded again, big game versus New Mexico Highlands tonight. We know the Fresno market will be watching. Well, we will be. And I think we can go ahead and say the D.C. market will be watching as well.
I got to think if I Google hard enough, I can find a Colorado School of Mines bar here in D.C.
There's
got
to be
action out tonight.
I can tell you in New York, their alumni club is just down the street from the Yale club. And I was a regular visitor. So I'm just telling you that right now.
You were just there to make fun of the people, or were you attempting to get into the Yale club?
I was learning about geology.
You were trying to get on a crew team, don't lie.
You're exactly right. I wanted to be the guy with, you know, in the front going, stroke!
Nobody ever wants to be the guy rowing the boat. I just want to be the guy in the front.
Yeah.
You still get a ring if you win.
That's it. That's the way to go. I think the guy that does that also is sucking down a beverage the whole time they're doing it. At least what I've watched him on the Schuylkill River in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia.
The good ones always do, my friend.
Yeah. He is Tony Landry. He is one of the good ones. He's the producer of Big Ten This Morning on Sirius XM, Channel 372. Always a great pleasure. We'll talk with you next week.
Sounds good, my friend. Enjoy the weekend.
All right, there you go. Coming up, we're going to go to the movies and maybe the hardwood as well with Nick Shager, film critic from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Esquire. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
Well, I was concerned that we were going to have an issue getting our guy Nick Shager, film critic for Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Esquire, and many other publications, whether we were going to have a difficulty in getting him in, because I know that he's been concerned, dialed in to his beloved Boston Celtics. But they have gotten things centered and rectified for now, but we will see where that goes going forward. We welcome back to the program Mr. Nick Shager. How are you, Nick?
Good morning, Christopher. I'm good, and as you said, the Celtics have, for the moment, decided to play like the team you might have hoped they would be, but we'll see after the All-Star break. It's been a schizophrenic season, and I don't really expect that to change, but you never know.
Well, I'll tell you, just as a matter of candor and full transparency, what I've said about the Celtics this week. They were, going into this year, the team that I predicted to come out of the Eastern Conference. I felt with Kyrie healthy, I mean, of course, it was only just, you know, the latter month or so that he missed, but it was the key time, you know, the playoffs, with Gordon Hayward coming back, with Jason Tatum having established himself as a rising star and somebody that conceivably 5 years from now could be one of the three or four best players in the National Basketball Association, I expected big things from Boston. That they're 16 games over 500, and this is, for me, this is a team that has underachieved so far for a variety of reasons. And then you start to hear rumblings, you know, you hear what Danny Ainge is saying about Kyrie Irving. You hear Kyrie Irving saying different things about what his future may or may not be. You hear Jason Tatum saying or hinting through social media and through others that he could easily see himself the centerpiece of the New Orleans Pelicans. And you have Gordon Hayward, who I just don't believe that he's still 100. He's back to 100%. He hasn't looked that way all year. You put all that together, and suddenly, going forward, the team that is tied with them right now, the Philadelphia 76ers, who they just beat, they seem to be more formidable with their starting lineup and their bench going forward than the Celtics do.
Well, you know, that you raise a whole number of good issues. And when it comes to the Sixers, all I can say is for a team that everybody seems to be so high on, and for a team like the Celtics, who everyone seems to be so low on, beating the Sixers again for the 10th time in the last 12 games without Kyrie Irving on the road and with the team on the skids shows that I don't really think the Sixers are for real either yet. And but we'll see. The Celtics, I don't think, are for real yet either. They've got a lot of problems. Hayward has played his best basketball in February, so hopefully that'll continue. You knew it was going to take time. As for Tatum being a part of a centerpiece deal, it's possible. I don't think Ainge wants to do that, but we're going to see how things play out. As for Kyrie, I'm not sure what to say about it. I think some of this stuff has been real because the team hasn't really, you know, achieved to the way people expected. I also think some of it's been misinformation. I think Rich Paul has been forwarding some of this because he wanted Anthony Davis so desperately to go to Los Angeles. My own take is that they, when they play well, they can be as good as anyone in the league, and they've played well against the best teams in the East. The problem is they play down to their competition, and I think they just have too many parts. And whether it's an Anthony Davis deal in the offseason or something else, they need a couple fewer guys because too many of these guys need some high usage. And when they don't get it, they don't play well. The team looks awkward and out of focus. And so we'll see.
Yeah.
I still think they have the potential to gel and be a beast in the playoffs, but just as likely they could fall apart. So, you know, we're going to find out in the next couple of months for sure.
My mom is streaming us right now in Philadelphia, and she is a diehard Sixers fan, and I'm already getting text messages from her about her thoughts about what you said. She said, he sounds like a typical Boston fan. I was like, settle down now, settle down.
As somebody who is married to a Philadelphia native and has a whole family on that side in Philadelphia, including my brother-in-law, who is a big Sixers fan, who, you know, obviously texts me all the time, I am well aware that Celtics and Sixers fans and that friction exists from a very personal place.
We'll have to talk sometime off air because I've got a lot of stories that go back to Red Auerbach because he used to sit he would sit about eight rows back behind where we sat on the aisle, and some of the things that went on, the byplay between fans and him, priceless. We don't have time to talk about it now, but you have to remind me. I will tell you some stories that'll just knock you out.
Sounds good.
Alita, Battle Angel. So this is the weekend's big release, as you have told me. I've seen trailer and I guess initially, you know, I don't know. I'm not a fan of the title, which may not have anything to do with anything. But that's just me. It seems like something that could be interesting, but then again, it could be also a complete and colossal waste of time.
Yeah, I think it falls somewhere in between there. You know, I think a lot of people expected Alita Battle Angel to either be magnificent or to be this Titanic dud. And I don't mean to use Titanic as a pun, given that the film is produced by James Cameron, and Cameron has long since tried to make this movie. He's been trying to make it both as a director and now as a producer for the better part of 20 years. He produced it. It's directed by Robert Rodriguez, who made, you know, Desperado and the Spy Kids films. And it stars a number of big names, Jennifer Connelly. It has two Best Supporting Actor Oscar winners, Christoph Waltz, who I spoke with for The Daily Beast about the movie, and Mahershala Ali. And it has this amazing science fiction sort of special effects spectacle going on. It's about a future America where the have-nots live on the ground and the haves, after an apocalyptic war, live in the sky. And a scientist finds a cyborg girl, puts her back together, and then she goes on a quest to recover her memory and to, you know, fall in love and to, you know, have a hero's quest. I think the film, from a special effects standpoint and a spectacle standpoint, does work pretty well. The big thing is that it's based on a Japanese anime manga graphic novel. And so they've done something with Alita where they've given her giant anime-style eyes, like with computer graphics. And I thought that was going to be the big sticking point, but it winds up working. And most of the combat stuff and spectacle works. My problem was the story is really unoriginal. Now, because this is based on a popular property, you can attribute some of that to the fact that so many movies in the you know, last 20 years have borrowed from Alita. And now when Alita comes out, even though it may be the source for some of these things, it doesn't seem that interesting. But I found it to be very formulaic in terms of the hero's journey. I thought that some of the stuff, there's a big subplot here where Alita has to participate in a sport called motorball. And it's basically rollerball, you know, from the 70s of James Caan. Things like that made it seem not really fresh in a way that it could be, but I do think that it works well enough on its own terms that people who go to see it aren't going to come out going, what a disaster. I just think they're going to not feel like it was as inspired as it could be.
You know, it's that's very well said, and boy, you said a lot there to unpack, and you mentioned Rollerball. That came out just a couple of years before I went to USC, and of course, who was the person who interviewed and auditioned me? John Houseman. and we used to joke about that. And I just remember the one thing I remember him say. He liked his work in that movie, but the one thing I remember him saying to us in a director's class was, "Sometimes you have to do things for the money." What your thoughts on that?
We have, as I said, there's an illustrious supporting cast in this film. It's got Christoph Waltz, who's won two Best Supporting Actor Oscars. It's got Mahershala Ali, who's won one Best Supporting Actor Oscar and may win another in a couple of weeks here at the Oscars. It's got Jennifer Connelly. It's got another big-name surprise cameo I won't ruin.
Good.
And so you have all of this star wattage, and yet, I mean, I wouldn't say that any of them are doing, like, their best work exactly. This is one of those things you take because you reach a lot of people, and I'm sure they pay you quite handsomely. And these days, with the tent poles dominating Hollywood and everybody being in a Marvel movie and the like, I think that's just par for the course.
And you use the word formulaic. Don't you find that a lot of films, and maybe I'm speaking too broadly, we're talking with our friend Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Esquire, movies that have this kind of theme, of plot line, it seems like too many of them do end up erring on the formulaic side.
Yeah, I think it's the safer way to go about things. You're already spending so much money and time and energy on creating some sort of fantastic world and doing so much with computers here. So much of this movie is computer augmented. It's hard to think of a single scene that isn't. So when you're putting all that effort in, it's almost safer and easier to build all of that stuff on top of a tried and true skeleton that people won't have to struggle too hard to understand. They'll be able to go along with the movie, and they will instead be sort of enraptured by all the bells and whistles that you're throwing at them without having to also sit there going, wait, what's happening? Who is this? Mm. What's going on? Instead, you can feel very comfortable and then just get yourself sort of acclimated to the craziness, for better or worse.
For better or worse. One more thing, for better, is going to be talking about a film that I really wanted to be better than I think Nick believes it was. It's not necessarily unoriginal, but it doesn't seem... again, just from getting some notes from Nick, that he was wild over it. It's called The Maestro. That and maybe The Umbrella Academy is next. One more thing is next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing for you today on this beautiful Friday morning here in the Central Valley of California. You know, when I read Nick Shager's reviews, and they're always so good. And I don't mean that he likes everything. I mean just his reviews, whether he likes something or doesn't like something, are always so well written. What Nick does, though, sometimes is he pulls out a word, and I'd like to think that of the many things in my life that I don't have, one thing I do have is a good vocabulary, and gosh darn it, he pulls out words that I've never heard of before. And he played the word torpor, the torpor card. Which means lethargy. And he used that talking about The Maestro. And I thought, boy, you know, when you play that card, or maybe it was, I was so lost when he used torpor. Maybe he didn't use it for The Maestro, but he used it somewhere. But which one was it? It wasn't The Maestro, was it?
It may have been. You know, the truth is, there are quite a few movies these days that are torpid.
Yes.
Well, this which one I specifically used it about, but the Maestro certainly has some problems in that regard, let's say.
Well, it's an off the beaten path movie, which you pointed out. I love this kind of subject matter. Tell folks what it's about and why, where maybe it misses, and maybe is there anywhere in there that it hits.
Yeah, The Maestro is a small release, and as I said in Variety earlier this week, I think it is a pretty decent alternative to big studio fare if people are looking for it this weekend. It's not great, it's not a masterpiece, but it does have some things going for it. It's a period piece, and it's based on a true story. It's about a famed movie composer named Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, who was an Italian-born guy who worked in Hollywood throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, I think even the 60s, and he worked on over 200 film scores, but most of those he worked on as sort of a ghost composer where he was brought in to help write some music and he didn't get credit for it. I think he's only credited officially with like 7 movies, but the story is about the fact that he also worked as a teacher, a music teacher in Los Angeles, especially for aspiring composers. And the main character in this film is a guy named Jerry Hurst, excuse me, who wound up working with him, trying to sort of start a movie music writing career. He had a number one hit, and after World War II, he left his family, went to LA, and tried to realize his dreams. The film's big problem is that it's a bit torpid. It has almost no real action to it. So often you feel like it's sort of dragging along, and that coupled with the fact that a lot of it is shot in sunlight, sort of through windows and whatnot, makes it a little too sleepy for its own good. But it is a really well-directed story. The young director who did it, a guy by the name of Adam Cushman, is, I think, really a talented guy. He has some real skill in this film. And the main character, played by Xander Berkeley is very good in it as well, sort of underplays what could be a kooky, you know, Italian musical genius role. He sort of looks the part, but he winds up underplaying it. I think there is something there. There's something really interesting in the film about trying to capture that moment when a teacher really unlock something in a student, and the student sort of comes to an epiphany, musically, inspirationally. I do find that very interesting. And so I think there's enough there that if people are looking for, you know, a little something different, a little something more mature and adult and low key, you could do a lot worse.
Well, John, fair enough. All right. We've got time for one more, and I want to talk about the Umbrella Academy, just because Netflix now turns out things like fast food. Most of it is good, not always, though.
Yeah, Netflix, of course, releases 18 things a week these days. And this one is one of their big ones. The Umbrella Academy is a 10-part series, debuts today. To put it succinctly, it is based on a popular comic book series that came out a few years ago. And it basically is something akin to a more dysfunctional take on the X-Men, about a group of supernaturally powered kids who are brought together by an eccentric billionaire, and he turns them into a crime-fighting team. But years later, they are all reunited after having, you know, been on the outs with each other by the father's demise. And from there, you get a really wide-ranging story about superheroes, about family. It's like the X-Men crossed with The Haunting of Hill House, crossed with five other things. There's time travel. There are evil villains. There's all sorts of stuff. I thought it was okay. I think people will certainly think it is perfectly serviceable if you're looking for that sort of thing, but it doesn't rise above that. Too much of it is, again, sort of derivative. And more to the point, I just feel like, you know, if you're going to do a dysfunctional superhero show, you should really, really lean into the dysfunction. And a lot of the dysfunctional stuff you see here, the siblings squabbling with each other, is of a pretty standard variety. So, you know, it could be worse. You get it for free on Netflix. It's an easy binge watch, but it's not going to light the world on fire.
Yeah, the parallel there is just like when you're going to see a play that's a British farce. If you don't go completely all out overboard, it's not going to work.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in this cluttered marketplace where we have so much superhero stuff and so much even dysfunctional superhero stuff, a comic that this is based on called Doom Patrol is also been turned into a TV series that premieres today on DC Comics' online streaming site. There's so much dysfunctional superhero stuff. You got to really stand out a little more than this.
The always superb Nick Shager, film critic for Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Esquire, and certainly other publications. Such a treat to have Nick join us. I will be out next week. That means that Nick won't be here unless he wants to do the whole show, which would be just fine. But then we will reconvene in a couple of weeks. Nick, enjoy your week. We'll talk in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good. Have a great couple of weeks, Christopher.
Thank you, sir. My thanks again to Nick Shager. Our encore of the week, Tom Van Haren, Tony Landry, my guy Russ doing his usual great work, and all of you folks, we hope that you watch tomorrow's big game out in New Mexico. The New Mexico Lobos take it on the Fresno State Bulldogs. I'll be on with Tony D today for about a half an hour at 3 o'clock, and then I'll be on ESPN Albuquerque until Monday, 11:30 to 1:30. You're on your own.